This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, December 23rd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. We released our first episode of 2021 on January 7th. Our subjects were the results of the two Senate races in Georgia and the riot at the U.S. Capitol. In the years since, we've covered the ongoing peddling of lies about the 2020 election results, the struggle for racial justice, the many consequences of intense political polarization, Biden's imperiled domestic agenda, the chaotic end to the war in Afghanistan, the worsening effects of climate change, and the all-consuming coronavirus pandemic. Today, you'll be happy to hear, on our last episode this year, we're doing something different. We're focusing on whatever good news we can find. I'm joined right now by Evan Osnos, who writes about politics in Washington. Hey, Evan.
Hi, Dorothy.
So it's become a running joke on this podcast, you know, another optimistic conversation about chicanery in Washington.
Yes.
You have been writing about both parties since the start of the Trump administration. And I wonder whether you feel like this strain of pessimism has affected the way we talk about the Biden administration.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I think there is a strange way in which some of the habits of mind that we developed over the course of the last 5 years have kind of taken over. It feels to me sometimes like we have a switch that's stuck in the on position. And there's a quality, I think, in Washington journalism, and I kind of have to criticize my own cohort here. I'm part of it. But there is a way in which the default assumption has sort of become that, okay, there may be some good news today, but the worst news is buried in there, or we have to look for it, and we have to put that in the foreground. And that's both, I think it's the sign of what's trying to be a vigilant mind, and that's a good thing, obviously. We want to hold our public officials accountable. We want to be skeptical. We want to be tough-minded. But there is a point at which that can sometimes almost occlude us to things that are actually happening that could happen and that should be noted in a way that might help people understand the full picture.
And earlier this month, in an op-ed piece in The Washington Post, Dana Milbank wrote that the media treats Biden as badly as, actually, or even worse than, it did Trump. One recent headline that Milbank cited, and this is real, was "The Case for Why Biden is Screwed." So, as you mentioned, you're arguably part of the Washington press corps. Is he right?
Yeah, I think in a very weird way, that was actually like a kind of bold column to write, because what he did, which was to commission, in a sense, an analysis of sentiment in news coverage based on the words that are used and the frequency and so on. And he found that actually empirically, it is true that there is this bias towards promoting the negative news over the positive news. Let's be clear. There is a ton of really bad news. We don't need to sort of pretend there isn't. We're living right now in a period when COVID is coming back. We're obviously inundated by signs of the president's unpopularity. But if you were a space alien who landed in this country right now and you looked at the statistical profile of the United States, you would actually find some encouraging things that I think we have to be able to hold two thoughts in our head at the same time. The fact is unemployment is down. The fact is there has been job creation since the beginning of the year on a level that we haven't seen before. We have a government right now that is more diverse at the top than we have ever had in an administration. These are things that matter to people. And also, I think in legislative terms, we have had some big things happen this year. And we've had the infrastructure bill that was passed. You know, presidents have tried to do that for a long time. We had this, the creation of these child tax credits that are historic anti-poverty measures. Sure, you have to be able to talk about those things at the same time as saying, and yet we will still be critical when we need to be in all the right ways in journalism. And I think that it's important to try to be able to do both.
Evan's correct. They've actually passed some very important legislation. I mean, they have now passed a $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill, which is going to put money into tons of things that actually really need it.
Jane Mayer is a New Yorker staff writer.
you know, public roads, bridges, transportation, upgrades for airports, power grids, $7.5 billion for electric car charging stations, and a lot of money into vulnerable communities, get the lead out of the water and bring broadband to sort of poor rural communities. I mean, these things actually really matter. They're sort of, and it wasn't possible to get it done before. So that's very important. And then that $1.9 trillion economic rescue bill that was passed. I mean, that in by any measure is a ton of money. And what did it do? It staved off what could have been catastrophic suffering during the pandemic. And in fact, instead, what we've seen is that, you know, vaccines are widely available. They're free. And, you know, unlike so many places in the world, I mean, that is kind of a success story, except for the fact that so many people in this country won't take them. So, you know, anyway, it's a mixed picture. It's a glass half full, half empty. And part of it is that I think, you know, people after Trump thought that maybe Biden would be able to fill it up to the top.
And they just, the Democrats, as always, and I've talked with others about this, they just don't know how to zero in and point out their successes. Now, part of it obviously is that Biden is, you know, completely overwhelmed by the new news every single day about the coronavirus pandemic. But there are better ways to project strength, one would think. How can the Democrats do that? How can they push back against the narrative that Biden is failing?
I mean, I was surprised recently in talking to somebody in the White House that they don't have much of a political office. I mean, they've got a political office that works with the Hill, and they've, you know, of course, and they've got, you know, some kind of public engagement with groups outside of Washington. But it struck me that, I mean, they don't have opposition research or any kind of research on what their opponents are doing. It looks to me like a much less sophisticated operation than I've seen, even going back to sort of the Reagan years. They don't do a tremendous selling job. I mean, it's, you know, they're hurting themselves by doing that.
We have been getting some good reporting in the last week or two about what the House Select Committee on January 6th is unearthing. And one of the reports was that Trump appears really unnerved by it. What are you hearing?
Yeah, I have seen the same. And I actually think the January 6th committee is another of the what I would put in the success categories for the Democrats. And it's actually a self-inflicted wound in some ways by the Republicans. Kevin McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, by spurning the possibility that they could have created a bipartisan commission, they have taken off that committee anybody who would defend them by not participating. And the committee is just plowing forward. And it's making tracks. I mean, it is really assembling what looks like a very impressive and devastating record. So, I think the Republicans made a huge mistake by, you know, turning their back on it.
Well, and even Mitch McConnell, whom you've written about quite a bit, he seems to be unnerved too. And you can just see the way his response to what the committee is doing is changing.
Yeah, it's been amazing to hear him say, well, he thinks that maybe it's important to learn what this committee has to say. I mean, he's wobbled back and forth on this, depending on how much courage he has about taking on Trump's base. And, you know, his enmity with Trump and vice versa seems to be worsening with him. Trump calling him names like the old crow and trying to get him unseated.
So there has been quite a bit of reporting about how Nancy Pelosi, as Speaker of the House, has managed to keep that very fractious caucus together. Yes, she's been there forever. It's time for younger leadership. But she does command a lot of fear and respect in both parties. Can you tell us a little bit about how you see her and what she's accomplished this year?
I mean, I personally think Nancy Pelosi has been dazzling. You know, she's held the Democratic House together, all the different factions of it. And, you know, I think she's the betting is that this may be her, you know, last period as the Speaker of the House. But she's been quite amazing. I think she has secured her place in history as one of the most remarkable, most successful, most powerful speakers of the House that we've seen in this country.
And on that note, thank you so much, Jane, for being here, as always.
I'm glad to be with you.
John Cassidy has been a frequent guest on the political scene as the economy has gone through its many COVID-era convulsions. Hi, John.
Hi, Dorothy.
Thanks for joining me once again this year. This time, I hope, for maybe a little holiday cheer. So as we come to the end of 2021, economists are warning that we're facing the end of historically low interest rates and the start of an inflationary cycle. But you have what you call an optimistic scenario for inflation. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how that might work.
Yeah, well, you know, I think everybody's so depressed at the moment, it's public service to try and give some sort of optimistic take. And on the inflation front, there actually is a reasonable one. It's basically going back to the same story we've had since the start of the pandemic, and that is that most of the increase in inflation is still can be traced back to supply chain issues and disruptions from the pandemic. So as a matter of common sense, you would expect that as the pandemic recedes, those supply chain issues would recede too, and inflation would start to fall. Now, that's what the Federal Reserve had been saying basically all the way up until about a month ago, when it changed its tune completely and then said, look, the inflation rate is not transitory. But if you look at the actual underlying analysis, which the Fed and other people still put out, it still actually does show that most of the increase in inflation, we got up to 6.2% in November, which is obviously a scary figure, still can be traced back to these supply interruptions. And if you look at the long-term forecasts, they're still showing inflation dropping back to 2 or 3% by the end of next year, which, you know, is a long way from an inflationary spike. And if that comes true, obviously all the scare stories about being returned to the 1970s would turn out to be completely wrong.
Also, it seems to me that there's some genuinely good economic news that hasn't gotten enough attention. Wages on the lower end of the pay scale have been rising generally faster than prices, and there's been a decline in child poverty and unemployment. How has the Biden administration's economic agenda contributed to these gains so far?
Well, wages have been going up, particularly for low-wage workers, which is obviously what we want to see because there's been wage stagnation for decades in that part of the distribution. That's something which should get more emphasis, definitely. Another positive development which you mentioned is the decline in the child poverty rate, and that one can be traced directly to the Biden administration. Part of it is just the general pandemic relief policies, the two big stimuluses that were passed, which, you know, basically gave people a lot of money handed out to see them through the pandemic. But there's also something more specific, and that is the expanded child tax credit, which Congress passed as part of the big Biden relief package, the American Rescue Act, in February of this year. And what that did, it took an existing program, the child tax credit, which basically gives credits to low-income families. And it turned it into a monthly child allowance scheme. The government started sending out checks to people, including to people who didn't previously earn enough to qualify for the tax credits. It's kept, it only started in February. It's kept 3.7 million people, children out of poverty since then. And that's a very, very positive development, obviously. Now, of course, there's a downside to this, and that is that the program expires at the end of this year. It was only funded for 1 year in the pandemic relief bill. If nothing's done by 12/31, it will expire, and now it looks like nothing will be done, of course, because the Build Back Better bill looks to be dead after Joe Manchin said he won't vote for it. So we have a very positive development there, but a very negative development in the last few days.
All right, enough of the caveats again, because we go down that road, there will be no end. The strength of the economy, as you and others have said, depends on getting the pandemic under control. The Omicron variant is spreading much more widely in the U.S. now. But at the same time, elected officials promised that we're not going back to the lockdowns of 2020. how significantly do you expect COVID to affect the economy in 2022?
Well, I mean, since the very beginning of the pandemic, I've been in the, you know, the school of it's the pandemic, stupid. I don't think you can really overstate the importance of the pandemic on the day-to-day impact on the economy. You don't need draconian lockdowns to have a big impact because people tend to lock themselves down. I mean, that's what certainly what our family are going out a lot less than they used to do. So I think we're certainly going to see a big short-term hit to things like the restaurant industry, movie theatres, hotels, etc. The lesson of history is that these things don't tend to last for very long. So as long as the Omicron wave is a relatively short one, I think we'll see something like we saw in the summer when the Delta wave hit, and we had one quarter of very actually negative growth, and then things bounced back quickly in the third quarter. The general story of the economy and the pandemic is that the economy is very resilient. Obviously, everybody is very depressed at the moment because of the Omicron wave, and I'm part of that camp too. But if you go back and look at the forecasts from the Federal Reserve and Wall Street and other places, right back in sort of March, April 2020, when the pandemic originally hit, they were really, you know, disastrous. People were talking about a second Great Depression, etc., and having 20% unemployment for months or even years on end. That hasn't happened. The pandemic, the policies which were introduced in the US and all over the world, really, to get the economy through this crisis worked. So the economy has proved itself resilient, and I think it will prove itself resilient in the face of the Omicron virus, as long as the Omicron virus doesn't turn out to be, you know, a lot more deadly than the Delta virus. The early signs are that we haven't seen that in South Africa and other countries, so let's just hope that that turns out to be the trend.
Okay, that's relatively reassuring. Thank you so much, and have a good holiday.
Thanks, Dorothy. You too.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Hey, Bill.
How are you?
Okay, are you feeling hopeful today, I hope?
Look, there's no way to do this without a little caveat that most of the news of this year on climate was actually quite bad.
We'll lead in with that.
Okay.
Yeah. Bill McKibben is a climate activist, the founder of 350.org, and a contributing writer to The New Yorker. You know, it is so hard to find good news about the climate these days. And this year in particular, it's been another year of more powerful hurricanes and tornadoes, wildfires, heat waves, you name it. And I don't see that the government, at least in this country, is making any big moves to avert total climate catastrophe. So when you try to stave off climate despair, where do you turn?
Well, so first, your observations are correct. It's been a difficult, difficult year. We've seen weather like the planet has never experienced before, and we haven't gotten action in Congress, where Joe Manchin, Prime Minister from West Virginia, continues to hold up any serious, you know, the first serious climate legislation that the U.S. would ever have passed. So one looks where one can for a certain amount of solace. There are two things that are going on that are worth investing a little hope in. One is that popular movements continue to grow. The best thing by far about the Glasgow climate talks was watching young people in particular picking up where they left off when the pandemic began, with real in the streets activism, of which we need more. And many of us are trying to figure out other ways to build that kind of groundswell. And we see it happening, say, with the rise in the number of places that are divesting from fossil fuel. This year saw a whole bunch of those, including the 10-year fight at Harvard, the richest university on planet Earth, which finally decided to stop trying to profit off the end of the world and divest from fossil fuel. So that's good news. The really deep structural thing that should give us at least a hope that there's some chance here is that the price of renewable energy continued to decline and decline sharply. And indeed, there were a series of studies and things, most prominently one from Oxford, that indicated that this is not just happenstance, that renewable energy turns out to be one of those technologies that's just on a relentless downhill cost curve. Unlike, say, fossil fuel, whose price jumps around from month to month, right now the price of oil is high, but that over the long term doesn't change very much because the technology doesn't improve. It's been pretty much the same since the 18th century. So hopefully, at some point, that combination of activism and economics will serve to overpower the combination of vested interest and inertia that's keeping us locked in place. It didn't really happen this year, but we're obviously a little closer to it than we've been.
I've also read that when you install solar panels on your roof or your barn or whatever, or your land, neighbors, there's a kind of copycat effect, a virtuous circle where other people start doing the same thing. Have you found that yourself?
Yes, and we're starting to see that kind of technology acceptance thing really blossom. When people poll Americans about what things in the country they like, the thing that gets the highest rankings, and it comes from Democrats, Republicans, and independents, is more solar power. Wind power is high up there too, but people love solar panels. And I think this is starting to happen with other technologies as well. This was the year when Ford previewed the all-electric F-150 pickup, most popular vehicle in America, but now it's going to come with a big battery and 9 plugs, and people are lining up to buy it. Lots and lots of people have already put down cash on the barrelhead expecting to get one of these trucks next year. Similarly, on a day or two before Christmas, the outgoing mayor of New York, Mr. de Blasio, will announce that the city has banned new gas hookups for new construction. If you're building a new apartment or office building in New York, you won't be able to put a gas line in. Instead, you'll have to figure out how to heat the place, cool the place, and provide cooking with electricity. The good news is that those technologies are here now too. The air source heat pump and quite beautifully the induction cooktop are really coming into their own as not just more environmentally sensible replacements for what was there, but superior technology that gets the job done better and cheaper.
Thanks so much, Bill. Really, really appreciate it, as always.
A great pleasure, and thank you for all your good work this year.
Let's wrap up today by going back to Evan Osnos. One of the things that's missing from just about any political discussion these days is a shared sense of the common good. All kinds of things have been proposed, changing how social media is regulated, fixing the gerrymandering of political districts, and so on. You wrote recently about an old-fashioned idea that is a favorite of mine as well, that's buried in the Build Back Better bill. And you point out that you don't think it gets enough attention.
Yeah. This is the prospect of large-scale national service. And it is the kind of thing, I will announce at the outset, is not the sexiest headline in the newspaper, and it doesn't get all that much attention. But, I mean, the idea is you take people, particularly young people, and you say, we will, for a year or two, put you to work, give you jobs which are designed to have people who have nothing in common politically, maybe in their own experiences, have very different lives, and you put them side by side. And the data on this is clear and kind of thrilling, which says that people are, over time, they get more tolerant by being in these environments. This is studies that go all the way back to the effect of being in integrated units during World War II. It simply has an effect on ourselves as individuals, as citizens. Let's make that happen. Let's give them that chance.
Do you have any idea who came up with that idea?
National service is something, amazingly enough, that actually does get support from very different kinds of politicians, people on the left and on the right. So you have Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat, and Roger Wicker, a Republican, who have both promoted versions of this idea. AOC supports national service, and so do some conservatives. So it is the kind of thing that has a way of cross-cutting our political divisions. Fundamentally, the idea of national service has deeper roots and perhaps more support than we don't talk about enough every day.
Well, that was therapeutic. So thank you, Evan, and talk to you soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dorothy.
Thanks so much to Evan Osnos, Jane Mayer, John Casty, and Bill McKibben. You can read all of their writing on NewYorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden. We'll see you next year. Have a safe and healthy holiday.